free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards
such Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net and get a past lineup of speakers as well as see who's coming down the pike and see our call-in numbers if you're listening live so you can join us during the question and answer session. Today we have a special program. It's a two-hour, possibly even three-hour special. We can run 3 hours if necessary. We're going to try and get it in two. The first session, the first half of the show will be me interviewing Jack Durbin. Second section of the show will be calls and question and answer from a forum who's trying to replicate a device he was involved with more than a decade ago. The device is called Stephen Mark's Toroid Power Generator, also known as a TPU. This was a solid-state device that produced copious amounts of energy, free energy from the environment. You wouldn't see where it's coming from, but there was this donut-shaped device that was putting out all kinds of power. It was powering appliances, 100-watt light bulbs, and other things that couldn't possibly be powered by battery technology that was then available. The energy was coming from somewhere else, but there were no extension cords, no fuel, no visible energy source, yet there was powering these things. And now, more than a decade after his experience with this technology, during his glory days, well after the NDAs had expired, Jack Durbin is ready to tell all. And so, Jack, thank you for joining us. We're glad you could come on.
Well, it's nice to be able to reach out to the guys that are in the trenches that have put in a lot of midnight oil trying to get this technology to work. And my main purpose in coming forward after all this time, well, first of all, an NDA did expire about 6 years ago, but I thought I would give Stephen plenty of time to resurface and potentially continue his efforts. But seeing that that did not occur, and the chances are that Stephen may not even be with us anymore, combined with the fact that I had a feeling that I could possibly lend a little bit of help to those who might be stuck somewhere in the development phase of the device.
And there is a large community of people. I would guess just, I'm not intimate to that group. I've been on the forum a few times, but I'm guessing that there are a few hundred people playing with that technology and a good several dozen who are really rolling up their sleeves trying to make this thing work and have been doing so for a number of years. And so a large segment of our audience today is going to be comprised of those people listening in to look for any nuggets that you might be able to bring forward that will help them get past some of the stoppages that they've gotten, you know, run into, so that they can replicate this technology and finally get it out to the marketplace where it could really turn things around in terms of the price of energy, the availability of energy. It would just really revolutionize. It would be akin to the invention of fire, the discovery of fire, in terms of the turning the tide on an era of scarcity of energy to one of abundance. And so we really appreciate you coming on. And there's basically two audiences that we're talking to here. The first segment, I would like to kind of gear to the lay audience who maybe has not heard about this technology before. And then the second segment, we're going to address more of those people who are directly involved in that forum and have some very specific questions about how did this thing work. And so that's kind of what we want to accomplish with this show. Let's start out by asking, and we do have a whole list of questions that people have posted in preparation for this show. There's been a lot of interest in anticipation of this show. And again, we thank you for, you know, your courage in coming forward and taking this step. I'm sure today won't be the only time you'll be answering questions.
Well, I appreciate the term courage because as a seasoned inventor and scientist, product developer of 30 years, it's risky to come forward and say, yes, I witnessed this device and it did work, because everyone in my industry would think I'm a kook, but that's not important anymore. In other words, I have enough track record behind me now and enough products on the market, 21 patents, either issued or pending. I've already paid my dues in my industry. I'm highly respected, and I no longer care if I'm labeled as one of the few lucky witnesses to one of the biggest breakthroughs in history.
Yeah, and so I just want to say more along those lines that it really is courageous for people who have a reputation to keep, so to speak, to go out into the fringe, so-called fringe, that of these technologies is supposed to be impossible, that defy the present laws of physics as we know them. But it's been people of such courage through history who have become the heroes, who are willing to go against the trend and introduce revolutionary new technologies, human flight being one of the best examples.
So what I'd like to do at this time, just so that I can develop a rapport with the listeners and to establish that I am real, that I paid my dues. I've been at this for a very long time. I've been an inventor since I was in high school and was designing engine blocks and all kinds of mechanical drawings long before then. I just had a knack for engineering. When I got into product development formally, I was fortunate enough to work with some top scientists, some rather well-known PhDs in various fields. And now to date, I have a couple hundred products on the market. Some you've heard of, some you haven't. The LED tennis shoes you see kids wearing all over, I invented that in 1979. Right after that, the lighted Frisbee, which these are all low-tech products, of course. But after that, the Gatekeeper locking shopping cart that is a huge success worldwide. It is a locking shopping cart that I designed a wheel that has a 15 kilohertz, or actually it's 8 kilohertz, I divided it in half, receiver in it that looks for a buried wire around the perimeter of a parking lot and then locks the cart up. Well, that sounds trivial, but the science that went into that technology to have it operate for 4 years or 15,000 lockups was substantial. So I have a lot of product in the optics industry, electro-optics, manufacturing. I automated the rocket nozzle assembly for the Titan and Shuttle mission programs for JPL, which was done through Rocketdyne in Chatsworth, California. So I'm very, very comfortable with prototyping, product development from scratch, new technologies where they existed not before. So I know what my fellow compatriots are going through right now in the development or the continuation of the Steve and Mark device, which I will get into further later, but Steve and Mark did not invent that device, nor could I say any current day inventors have. This device goes way back, and it's being introduced all over the world. In fact, there are, I shouldn't say introduced as in introduced to market, but introduced into the hands of developers, that this device goes way back into history, and this is not a new technology.
Yeah, we'll want to get into that a little bit more later. Now, since Stephen Marks was kind of the pivot point in this technology, there have probably been some million people who have seen his video on YouTube, a number of videos actually, where he's showing this thing powering different devices. One that most people have seen is in a very wealthy home. What is your role in Stephen's toroid project of a decade ago?
Okay, perhaps we could start off by stating that toroid is really of no significance in this design, in that the only reason why he built the devices on any circular devices because it was easy to wind. And it just so happens that the large unit, which I believe is 15 inches in diameter, I've seen 16, but I don't believe that's the case, that was actually wound on a stack of speaker mounts that came from the Spheric Audio line that I was also working with that later became Extreme Technologies. So The fact that it's toroidal is only indicative of its shape and geometry, having nothing to do with the topology of the orientation of the coils. In fact, the technology resembles a Tesla patent that was issued in 1888 that looks like it was cloaked by Tesla himself to possibly disguise the technology as a mechanical or more conventional type generator.
That patent number?
I don't have it in front of me, but it's in my files. In fact, I identified it very early in the process when I first witnessed the device that it looked familiar to me because I'm a big fan of Tesla, and it looked like one of his devices. It did issue in 1888, and I...
381970.
That sounds familiar. Anyway...
I gave him the email a couple days ago.
Right, that's the one. So, where would you like to go from here? Because there's a very interesting story behind Steve and Mark, and I don't want to destroy his character in front of the world here, but you guys need to know the ones that are really fighting hard to get this technology out.
Let's get into that a little bit later, and I do want to touch on that, but for the sake of the replicating audience, let's not spend too much time on that particular aspect. Where I'd like to go next is the question of how were you involved and how well did that technology work?
Okay, well, as a product developer, I had a shop over in Laguna Niguel, which is about 20 miles to the south of the Lemon Heights mansion where Stephen was set up. And his associate, we'll get into what that relationship was between Stephen and this gentleman later, but he reached me through the Yellow Pages, of all places, because I haven't advertised there in probably 10 years since, but he reached me through the Yellow Pages, said he had a top-secret project that needed help, and we met at my office, and then before long, he disclosed to me that it was a free energy device. I had already seen quite a few technologies that failed. In fact, I was a clearinghouse for not only free energy technology, but alternative medical devices. I worked with Barry Lines with the Rife technology. In fact, we formed a company together before he had to hit the road because of FDA trouble. But I was used to seeing this technology before, and most all of them I don't want to call them frauds because there was a lot of well-intentioned people that thought their technology did work, but they failed to stand up to testing. So anyway, after I met this gentleman, his name was Mercury Marilla. If anybody is intimately knowledgeable of Stephen, they'll recognize that name. It doesn't show up in any public documents, but he was a key player when it comes to being involved with Stephen in a personal way. Anyway,
how do you spell that? Mercury Marilla?
Yeah, it's spelling Mercury like the planet or the
material,
and then Marilla, M-A-R-I-L-L-A. He can be found in criminal records. You won't find much on him public records, but if you go into the California prison database, you'll find him there.
So he contacted you, and what was their request?
Well, the mission was, the first mission, actually, was to replicate the technology. But, unlike, I saw some of the questions that were coming in on the board, and one gentleman, I believe it was Earl, asked the question, well, if you were given access to the technology, how come you couldn't duplicate it? Well, that wasn't the mission. The mission was to find a way to replicate the output or the ability to produce free energy by any other means other than what Stephen had developed. And at first, my thinking was that he was just trying to see if he covered all his bases or if someone else completely outside from the cold could come in and get as far as he could or replicate his findings or perhaps find a way to have someone else do the dirty work because he was stuck at a particular place where I actually believe that most everyone is stuck now and still in the same place after 10 years. But I regret. He wanted me to actually come up with any type of technology, didn't care, but just to produce the same results. So we went into a mode of doing typical Tesla type of remote, primary, secondary type transmission, which is well known and very simple to do. And we even went into microwave and did some point-to-point short-range through the air, 10 feet, 20 feet transmission of power, which is, grossly inefficient and didn't provide much useful information. So after we completed that and turned in the various versions of this technology, I soon learned and really felt deep down that what Stephen was really trying to do, he was at the point where he was supposed to turn over the technology to investors. And I think to stall that off, he was really trying to find something that was close enough that he could pawn off on investors so that they would be happy enough to get off his back. Because by the time I'd met Stephen, I could tell that there had been quite a few investors coming and going, and I think the pressure was really building on him to deliver product. But knowing the man now and during that time, I realized that his ego was much bigger than his need to deliver the product. I mean, to be the one guy, at least that we all knew of at the time, to have the technology meant more to him being king of the hill than to release this to the world and potentially save our energy requirements.
Did you meet him in person very often, or was it more secondary through other people who were interfacing with you?
No, I've worked with him at the mansion probably maybe 10 times over a six-month period. We did not have a lot of shared time on the bench or, with the unit because he was very paranoid. And whenever he did demonstrations, he was very careful not to reveal too much if he had the sense that engineers were around. And even though I was on the same team and I was part of the family, he was even careful with me because I think he could tell that if I just had enough time with the unit and I could take it apart or at least help him build one, that I would discover just how simple the technology was. And I can attest that it was very simple because the fellow, the same guy who hired me to come into the project, did a lot of his gopher work and told me straight up that most everything in the product or in the device was purchased at Radio Shack. I mean, we're talking very basic wire like bell wire or standard prototyping type wire, a reed switch, a magnet, and a couple other components. And everything else, there was two other components that I recognized right away, and it was a large polypropylene cap and a choke that was sitting on top of the large 15-inch diameter unit. So basically, this is not a very complicated device. It's just very complicated to get working properly.
So the components are simple. It's a matter of how you put those components together that was the trick.
So to speak, but the important thing is that the winding of the unit was very laborious, and output levels could be changed based on ratios and things like that. This is a very fundamental device that is not very sophisticated. It's just very unstable and difficult to tame. And one little side note regarding that is the original units were incapable of running inductive loads, as in motors, mixers, or anything like that. And that's when we parted company, was when he could not run an inductive load. Since that time, evidenced by videos, he was doing a demo before some gentlemen, where this is the only tape he actually shows his face, which I thought was interesting, because in every other tape, especially the one shot by his attorney, Kavanaugh, he does not reveal his face. But in that video, he does show the running of a drill, and I believe it was a handheld vacuum or something like that. So he must have advanced the art a little, but he was not a very intelligent guy. I see the deification all over the Internet regarding him, but this is not the kind of guy that invented this device. He came across it somehow and tried to make it work, but as a tinkerer, I believe he's probably still at the same place he was 10 years ago.
And so others were involved in making the devices, and he was more the front man?
No. He was the only guy that knew how to do it inside the entire group. There were people around like David Dolshaw, who was a PhD from UCI here in Irvine, that I worked with quite a bit. And we all talked behind the scenes as to what the device was, what it was doing, but nobody, and I mean no one in the entire group, including investors, family, or whoever, knew the deep down dirty details as to how the device worked, and that includes myself. In fact, I've made it very clear publicly on your site that I'm not here to represent, that I can tell you how to finish the device, how it worked. I can give you some hints as to the direction I was heading to make it work, but Stephen was very paranoid because this device was not that difficult to figure out, that he did not want anybody looking over his shoulder or he would become instantly obsolete. The millions of dollars that were pumped into this man by a lot of very well-intentioned people, a couple guys that I knew of were a little bit shady and where their money sources were coming from, but for the most part, a lot of people put their trust and faith in this man, and I feel that he was obligated to deliver, and he never did, and that caused him a lot of problems.
Now, he originally got the technology, you said, from a guy in France?
Well, no, I believe I don't want to use the word steal, but let's say he borrowed it from someone else and tried to perfect it, and chances are good it's probably some old guy sitting in a lab still today trying to make it work, and Stephen took it upon himself, and there's just no way with this guy's background and what I knew of him working together. In fact, I'm going to give you a couple bombshells today that will further support my belief that Stephen was not only a fraud, but he was not a technical person. This guy was a tinkerer, and that also goes to the simplicity of the device. I would venture to say that any middle schooler with an A-level technician program behind them on the back of a matchbook could build this product.
And there were a number of iterations. The videos show three or four different sizes, shapes, combinations. They all were in toroid shape, but there were different sizes, and so he didn't just build one.
Well, no.
So that's got to say something about a level of skill.
Not really, because the technology is scalable. If it works at 8 inches, it'll operate at 16. It'll operate at 24 and perhaps 4. It's the configuration and the topology of the coils that is significant. I'm sure there is a point of diminishing returns as you miniaturize, but the design itself is highly scalable. In fact, you could probably go infinitely large on the overall assembly and increase efficiency or decrease efficiency. I'm sure there's trade-offs in the real estate and how it's utilized in the physical sense, but no, this is just a matter of scale. If you look at the devices up close, and I have one of the master copies that they were using to give to investors, and it very clearly shows that all the devices are nearly identical in their layout. It's just scaling.
You say you have one of the master video copies?
Yeah, it's a very clear one, much better than the stuff you see on YouTube.
And you're going to be posting that on your site in a few days.
Yeah, and in fact, my site's way behind because I'm turning out a new consumer electronics product right now for a group, and I've just been working day and night on that. And now, ever since meeting you, I can't finish my website, so I'll be getting back to that.
Well, let's go ahead and give the domain name out while we're talking about it.
Okay, my original site is vorel.com. It's V as in Victor, O-R-E-L. And that is a very old site, but shows some of my prior projects. It's about half of what I've completed since then. And then the new one is vorelco, vorelco.com.
Now, another thing is with the number of iterations of this thing, the number of videos and people who were seeing this thing, how did he cloak it so that people couldn't look under the cover, so to speak, and see how this thing worked?
I'm glad you asked. He actually, one of the tricks he deployed that I thought was rather amusing was using a magnet to drop into a little receptacle that would cause the device to come to life. And all that was a reed switch that was hidden inside the receptacle so that when the magnet was placed in the proper orientation that the unit would fire up. But if you noticed, he went to great lengths to wrap the windings with electrical tape. The large unit you see was the one that I was much more familiar with than the smaller units, because they seemed rather insignificant to me compared to this large unit. But it was built on a large frame that, you know, it was probably just a hunk of baseboard. I mean, what's the particle board? But the circular shape, once again, was just a stack of speaker mount rings that he got from Spheric, which was his audio company that I also worked with. And he was able to just cloak a lot of the internals by just how he built the unit. But this device is not sophisticated by any means. You would think there's MOSFETs and all kinds of triggering devices and relays, and all, there's none. There is no solid-state technology to this device that I'm aware of at all. Nor would I consider Steve and Mark capable of even knowing which end of a diode to use where.
So wouldn't there be some kind of a control circuit to make this thing work?
I couldn't tell you, but based on what I saw firsthand, that when it was running, it did exhibit all of the physical characteristics as advertised, the resistance to motion, the gyroscopic feel, which right away triggered my memory of the Tesla patent, the one we just discussed, in that the way it was switching, you could tell that the quadrants were firing in an angular pattern, so that you could actually feel the thing energizing each one of the quadrants. So you could feel it resisting motion, in the sense that as each of the quadrants would fire, you would feel a force in that particular area at very high speed, of course, but you could tell that it resembled a conventional motor at low RPM, as if it had an off-centered eccentric on the shaft. You know, you could feel the vibration in it running, but there was no mechanical parts, and that's what I found fascinating. Another reason for getting together today is to clarify a couple suspicions that I saw on YouTube, and I'm sure many other people have it, is this device was demonstrated on the hood of a car in a Tustin strip mall in front of the president of Spheric, which then became Extreme Technologies. And this is a very credible man. I worked side by side with him for a while, and it worked there, therefore diffusing the concept or theory that it was a Tesla device with a, you know, a hidden transformer in the basement or some remote location, so this device could be demonstrated wirelessly.
Wouldn't it be possible, though, that they had another vehicle nearby that was acting as the transmitter?
No, because the mass of the vehicle being steel would completely crush the coupling effect of the lines of force between the primary and
second.
So they
were inside of a vehicle outside a strip mall.
Yeah, pretty tough to pull off.
Okay. Now, I understand that if you turn the thing upside down, it would stop working.
Well, I found that very odd, and I thought that that really had more to do with one of two things, and this will sound very simplistic, but I wouldn't write it off entirely. If you recall the magnet idea, where he drops the magnet into a receptacle, the read switch was at the bottom of the receptacle. If he didn't think about what was happening there, if you turn the unit upside down, the magnet would slide to the upper portion of the container and likely allow the read switch to open. Now, I know that sounds really simple, but that could have been the original problem. It was just a simple matter that the magnet was now moving out of position to activate the read switch. If that's not the reason, I can't explain at all why the device would work in one orientation and then flipping it 180 degrees would cause it not to. That makes no sense at all to me in the world of physics. That should be exactly the same.
In terms of output, what was the largest output that this thing ever produced, or any one of the devices?
Well, the only one I was familiar with intimately was the larger unit, and that was tweakable. In fact, I could tell that Stephen was optimizing the output so that when he would do a demonstration for the light bulbs, that it would be close to a value that people would be familiar with for household use. There was no doubt that he was trying to avoid an odd output that might be at 60 volts because it would be hard for an investor to equate that to being useful potential.
So 100 watts was the max of what it produced?
No, it was 100 volts. It was I don't remember the exact output. In fact, it's even revealed in the videos. But the target voltage was near line voltage, which is 110, 120, depends on how you look at it. But the amount of output power was around 1,000 watts.
Okay. Because, yeah, he was saying that it would put out as much as 5 to 10 amps, and at 100, 120 volts, that's going to be up there in the region of 1,000 watts or 1 kilowatt.
Yeah, and that to me wasn't all that significant because it was a scalable device, and therefore with doubling or halving the number of turns here or there, it always seemed like that could be tweakable.
In terms of the material cost of that device to put out 1 kilowatt, how much would you say that the materials would cost to build one of those?
In volume, or onesie twosie, probably under $50. In volume, probably $8 to $12. But it's all labor.
1 kilowatt unit for $8 to $12 in materials.
Yeah, but the labor is intense. I mean, if you had these things wound in China, where I have a lot of my products built, you could be turning these things out all day long for $20 a unit and be selling them for $995, depending on who owns the what.
Uh-huh.
Oh, by the way, there was a question regarding patents. There were no patents filed that I was aware of at the time, and now, after this many years, of course, the patentability goes away because of public disclosure. So no way that anybody out there could be filing a patent on this device because it's long past that phase.
Yeah.
You have 1 year from date of inception to file a patent.
You mentioned in your outline that there was a heat problem, that the thing would overheat after about 30 minutes.
Actually, the magic number is 20. And for all the guys out there that are trying to make this work, you all have that problem because the people around the globe that have been at this a lot longer than most of us report the exact same phenomenon. For some reason, and I've heard the number 19 and I've heard the number 20, but it's a very consistent point of failure, and it's yet to have been explained. I have some solutions to the problem that I could discuss on the second half of the program or whenever you desire, but I have a way of getting around that limitation, and it may or may not work. It's subject to a lot of prototyping.
Uh-huh. So if you were to look at a curve of the heat of this device, did it all of a sudden jump at 19 to 20 minutes, or was it linear and at 19 to 20 minutes it reached the critical point and shut down?
It looked non-linear in that it got warm within a couple minutes of just handling it, and that was just the amount of time it took to go from the wire windings in through the tape and to be able to feel it. But toward the end, before it collapsed, there was almost an exponential heating. You could tell that at some point there was a knee that it hit that caused it to become so unstable that it was going into a meltdown. I mean, it was dramatic toward the end, right before it was shut down. So you're right. I would say it's non-linear.
So if there's some kind of a phenomenon of a cyclical type of thing going on here, you could get around that by having a number of units and having them take turns, couldn't you?
Well, that was one of my ideas that I wanted to explore with Stephen, one of which was actually to submerge the unit into oil that would be non-conductive and would help dissipate the heat, protect it from flashover because there would be no oxygen to oxidate, so therefore no flare-up. And that's what we use for RF development. When we're developing large transmitters, when we need a dummy load to drop, to pump a bunch of RF into, we put a dummy load inside of a barrel or a bucket of oil, and the heat's dissipated, and there's no chance of explosion. With his device, he actually tried submerging it in water, which would be the last thing I would even think of to do with any type of device that develops high voltage, but nonetheless, he gave it a try, further supporting that he really just didn't know what he was doing.
Uh-huh. I have to get back to something that seems like an inconsistency to me, because earlier in the segment you said that you were brought on board to not to replicate his design, but to come up with something that would approach it, and that what you were working on was a transmission device, microwave frequencies and whatnot. That would seem to argue in favor of his device being some kind of a cheater device that is transmitting wirelessly, and it's basically a receiver. It looks like it's a generator, but it's a receiver for some units in the basement or some other location. Maybe you can help me clarify that you were working on a transmission, wireless transmission technology, to approach what he had, and that you're saying that his was not a receiver-transmitter scenario.
Well, he didn't actually specify what the program would be at all. It was completely left up to me as to which approach that I would try to replicate the device. In other words, he wasn't asking for any specific way to get there. I think he was really just trying to find any means at all to produce any power wirelessly, which all devices that, you know, that we're talking about are inherently wirelessly. That doesn't mean that there is a transmitter and receiver. It just means there's no wires connected to a power source. So he didn't care how I got there. He was just hoping that I could come up with something that would just produce a minimal amount of power through the air. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that he wanted a transmitter. He may have wanted me to try to find the same way he got to where he was. I think what he was really looking for was a device quickly that he could give to investors and say, this is how far I've gotten, this is where your millions of dollars went, so he could continue developing his own product without surrendering it.
Now, in terms of what he had, the understanding is that his was not a receiver, it was a generator. It was harnessing energy from somewhere, whether it was zero point in or some electromagnetic source of energy we don't understand. But it was a generator of electricity.
Well, I think it's a matter of semantics. The device could be considered a receiver if it is genuinely operating in the Schumann cavity, which is the reciprocal of the distance between the Earth and the ionosphere. And if that's the case and that is the formula that all these devices work on, then one could really call this a receiver in that it's operating in resonance.
And let's talk about that for a minute, the Schumann cavity and the ramifications that we mentioned on the phone yesterday in our chat.
Well, there is a potential problem, and that is having to do with submarine communications. And I know this will sound like a huge leap of intelligence, but there is a good chance that even when this technology is fully developed, that it's going to run into some regulatory problems. And that's something I'm very familiar with. Everything I do in the way of product development, I have to go through some three-letter agency to get approvals. And if this device is genuinely operating within the Schumann cavity, and it were to produce interference that could interfere with our submarine communications, which I know sounds like a huge leap, but the same Dr. Schumann is responsible for both of these areas. And if that were to interfere with any DOD operations, there's a lot more to worry about in developing this technology than having an Arab wacky over the head because of his oil kingdom coming to a collapse.
So if this device is harnessing the Schumann cavity or the Schumann effect, which is earthbound, so you wouldn't be able to use this thing in space, then it could have potentially interfere with the submarine communication network, and that would therefore make it prohibitive from being developed as a extant energy solution.
Yeah, and I know it sounds like a big reach, and that may not be the issue, but the prevailing issue would be FCC and DOD. If you end up creating a device that radiates a large amount of harmonics that end up wiping out any communications anywhere, and we're talking about just interfering with a garage door opener or the dongle on your keychain that unlocks your car door, if this device radiates energy that falls into FCC requirements like Part 15 and others, it's going to be real difficult to get this on the market without a lot of shielding. So once again, the device, bare bones, sitting open frame, could be generating enough hash to be detectable from long distances unless it's shielded.
On a tangent in support of that concept and that awareness, another technology invented by Joseph Newman that was replicated by, and his name escapes me, I apologize, but I interviewed him about 6 months ago. He built the thing for about $200, and the thing ended up being a weather modification device that could affect tornadoes, hurricanes, could bring in rain, drive away rain, depending on how you oriented this thing. The super cheap device was having humongous effects on weather.
Yeah, and therein lies government intervention again. Anytime you can have that much cause and effect over a large region of area like that, DOD unquestionably will be involved.
Yeah. So what would be the easy way to rule this out?
Well,
that's not a Schumann effect involved.
Well, that's just the mystery behind the device. I'm sure there are others out there that can answer that question better than I can. I've dealt with resonant technologies in other areas where you have to get something to resonate to operate properly or to be stable. We use it in ultrasonics and all kinds of other areas where you have to maintain like a Colpitts oscillator that is stabilized and has to maintain a certain frequency. If these devices rely upon the receiving of something like this, what might be the Schumann cavity, and I'm not even sure it is, but if they do, to shield the device to keep it from radiating could completely undo itself because it needs to be able to receive something that may be blocked by the shielding process itself. So it could be a real dog chasing its tail here when it comes to trying to design this to meet regulatory compliance.
In terms of the device operation itself, was it a self-looping thing so it produced energy? Did it require some kind of excitation primer that could then be provided once the thing was running? And let's say you've got a 9-volt battery that gets the thing started, and then it self-ran itself once it was going, or was that not involved?
Well, you know, that's where visually I could not see any external battery or internal battery. If he were to somehow submerge a couple AA cells or something like that inside in a compartment or inside the plate that was on the bottom, that's entirely possible, and I could have missed that. It's just that the way this thing was built, for him to have encapsulated batteries anywhere, it would have been a real pain in the rear to have to be able to rip the thing apart every time to dig in and be able to service batteries. Now, perhaps if the thing started on some type of excitation that came from a battery and then the battery was removed from the circuit right away, perhaps there wasn't enough current being used to have to be able to service the battery. So perhaps the thing would last for a good couple years of demonstrations without having to dig out a battery. But for the sake of me, I could not find anything that resembled batteries. And I use lithium ion and lithium poly ion in a lot of my products, and believe me, at the time that device came out, lithium ion was just a whisper in a laboratory. It was not commercially available yet.
Now, at one point, they actually took this thing apart. They sawed into it. Were you part of that? Were you looking over their shoulders when that happened?
No, and I've seen reference to that, and I can't understand why Stephen would hack one of these in half unless somebody else did.
I remember seeing video footage of that process. It's linked on our site about the toroid. I think the keywords at pezwiki.com are Stephen Marks and toroid. We have that video on there, and they actually show the different segmentation of it on the video. It's not very high res, but you show them, it shows them doing, but that was after you were involved?
You know, your voice level has dropped at least 6 dB. Have you changed a mic, or are you further away?
Yeah, I've had to switch to a cell phone. I apologize.
Okay, you dropped out there. If you could repeat the question, please.
Yeah, I was saying that at one point they show video footage, and we've got a link to it from our coverage, that shows the unit being chopped into pieces, and they show the different segments on the video. Did that happen after you were involved?
I can't honestly say if it was before or after. I never saw anybody hacking anything. I can say that on pretty good knowledge that there was a break-in at the mansion, and someone did try to take the technology. So if they were successful, that might have been a third party taking it apart and trying to see how it worked, or I don't know what the motive would be by putting it on YouTube. That sounds counterproductive.
Mm-hmm. Now, when this thing was, let's get back to the heat for a second. It would overheat. Could you then turn it off and then turn it back on? How long did you have to wait before you could turn it back on again?
I'm not privy to that. I just remember that when it shut down, that was it, and then we were moving on to other things. It wasn't like I was there long enough to see what that rest period was.
Did they ever have device runaway where they had a rapid or violent meltdown or some kind of a catastrophic failure?
No, I was never witness to that.
Mm-hmm. Were you present when any videos were shot?
No, Stephen made it a point not to have anybody around but Bill Kavanaugh. He's the guy that's holding the camera is his attorney.
And I should mention that one of the members of the New Energy Congress, Ken Rasmussen, recognized him as the patent attorney and said that he's a highly credible individual and that Stephen Marks had to have something significant to have his attention.
But is that actually Kavanaugh or somebody that appeared in a later video where you see several gentlemen in suits?
Could have been later. He recognized somebody at one point in one of the videos as someone that he recognized and raised his eyebrows as to the significance of the credibility factor.
Yeah, and you know what is strange about that is that Stephen had made public the device to so many parties that patentability was no longer an issue. I mean, he had 1 year from first demonstration to file at least a provisional. Of course, back then there were no provisionals, but at least a disclosure document. But I know of no such act, and I don't think he really was that sophisticated to think about mandatory filing dates.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that there was a patent attorney present means more to me that he was a representative of an investor that was having him present as a consultant to possibly say, yes, this appears to be patentable, but such a comment would be unfounded without research, without doing a patent search.
Was the output of this device ever put on an oscilloscope and viewed that way?
No, in fact, there wasn't an oscilloscope to be found. Stephen, like I said, I would put his technical prowess at Radio Shack cashier level. I mean, I don't mean to be so cruel, but he intentionally surrounded himself with a bunch of audio equipment that I now have half of it in my lab, and I'm looking at it right now, to try to make him look like he was more technically savvy, but it was all audio gear. In fact, the videos you see the small unit on, it's a black surface with vented slots in it. That's a stack of two or three, depends if all three were there. I think actually there were three altogether. I got three anyway. But there were Sony VHS machines sitting there, and above that, you see EQs and amplifiers. Well, he thought that that was going to make him look more credible when guys came around for the demos, but they're irrelevant. They're completely detached from the process.
Let's take a second and talk about some of these, the 3D project that he had in terms of the credibility and the personality of Stephen Marks and the bombshell that you've mentioned.
Well, yeah, I've been wanting to hold off on this a bit, but I'm going to do it anyway. I did give Stephen the opportunity to come forward to talk me out of going in this direction, because if he were still alive or at least responding to communications from confidants that I've been able to reach that do communicate with him, I would not bring this forward, but it goes to character. And as much as I regret this, Stephen was homosexual. And not saying that there's anything wrong with being a homosexual. And I am not a homophobe. But it goes to the lifestyle that he led, that he hung around with a lot of questionable characters, one of which was Mercury Marilla, that was, how to put this delicately, was arrested for exposing himself to children in, I believe it was a Broadway department store. It was either at South Coast Plaza or over here at the Mission Viejo Mall. But this was Stephen's boyfriend, and it was just a really, I'm trying to do this, you know, and it's very uncomfortable for me, but the lifestyle was such that he would take investor money and not think twice about going out and renting a yacht out at Newport Harbor and having all his boyfriends out there whooping it up and just spending money hand over fist that was intended to go toward development of the product. And one of the things that led possibly to his demise or to his current health problems could be what results from a gay lifestyle during the 80s and 90s where protection probably wasn't priority one. But it goes to personality, lifestyle, life choices, and unfortunately, Stephen never felt obligated to turn over the technology and just continue to make promises he couldn't keep. When it comes to the 3D audio system, this is bombshell number two. It was a complete fraud from start to finish, and I didn't know any better because I was giving him the benefit of the doubt just because he appeared to be a nice guy, and I wasn't learning about all the other things until I was around long enough. But the 3D audio project was a device that purported to revolutionize the Dolby-like experience in a theater. They built a large theater demonstrator that I eventually had in my shop in Laguna Niguel. It was a huge room with multi-tiered seating and a screen and a projector and all that. And what Stephen represented to Hollywood, and a lot of very big names, I had to meet with some of them, one of which was ICM. It's a talent agency in the Hollywood. And what happened was that the device made you think that you were hearing 3D sound, so that anywhere in the theater you sat, you would get the feel of Dolby-like surround, but even to the next level. And when, in fact, all Stephen was doing was creating a false atmosphere by simply positioning speakers all over the room and not revealing the fact that the speakers were hidden. So one would get the feel of surround sound, but it was complete BS. And what came of that, or how that culminated, was one day after millions of dollars pouring in from a couple companies, one of which is responsible for the transducer technology you see on rides at amusement parks, and a device called Aura, A-U-R-A, which was a device for gaming where you would sit against the cushion and the cushion would give you a punch every time something blew up in the video game or something like that. And these guys were behind it. There was a guy named Rob Alexander from Canada that was pouring a ton of money in. And there was a guy and a couple, you know, there was a few other guys too, just pouring cash in, thinking that if they didn't get the franchise, perhaps the sound device would work and all that. But what ended up happening is one day, one of the key investors had their engineer on, and this guy was a top sound guy from Hollywood, and we were all on a conference call. And this guy asked, look, I have filled out the NDAs, we have a relationship, I want to know the bottom line, what the technology is right now. And you could tell that they've had enough of all the meetings that were canceled because Stephen would fake heart attacks and stomach aches and all kinds of other things. That's how he got all his investors to go away, was just last-minute ailments. Well, Stephen finally came forward over the phone and said, well, here's what you do. You take the slider on the 3K and you put it here, put it in. The guy says, wait a minute, are you talking about equalizer settings? And Stephen says, yes, but it's very specific. You know, before he could finish his sentence, the party on the other line said, that's the end of the phone call. Thank you. You have nothing, and that's what we thought. The whole thing was a fraud. So to rescue the company, which at the time had just become Extreme Technologies, I developed an audio device that admittedly was not rocket science. It was just a matter of expanding the stereo depth. It was a matter of summing and differencing different components in location of instruments. And we did do a demonstration for KISS FM. In fact, the unit was used for broadcast for a while. And it still wasn't enough to raise enough money to continue the company. So we ended up with a warehouse full of speakers, speaker frames, coils, and all kinds of devices that ended up being liquidated. And I inherited quite a bit of it. I had to liquidate on eBay to pay their bill because they couldn't afford to pay me anymore.
So that was basically the demise of Stephen Mark's credibility. And did he get any more additional investments after that?
No, after that, things got real bad. And that's when I heard about a break-in occurring at the mansion. I could be unclear about that. It might have occurred at the Anaheim address, but I think that's when Stephen went underground because there was enough angry people wondering what happened to all the money that they were willing to do whatever it took to get their hands on the technology, and that meant even breaking in.
Okay. So the name of the company was Extreme Technologies Incorporated, or what was the...
Oh, let me see. I'm going to be putting up all their collateral materials on my site just for old time's sake. But, yeah, it was Extreme Technology. I can't remember. Back then, there were no LLCs, so it must have been an Inc.
Okay. Let's go ahead and mention, you said that you had a couple of ideas about how to address the overheating. Let's go into that a little bit.
All right. Now, there is a possibility that the overheating is just a byproduct of how the technology works, but it seems to me that there has to be some stability issue with the device that, if addressed, would prevent the overheating. But let's pretend that it is just a given and you can't get away with it. What I would do is I would put a thermal monitor on the device and have a bank of devices, say 5 to 10 to 20, it doesn't matter, as long as they're spaced at a distance where they don't interfere with each other, but just do simple bank switching. As a device reaches thermal overload, disconnect and switch to channel 2 and continue to do that in a fashion just like you do bank switching. Now, the way I would do it is I would isolate the load from the device in so much as charging a very friendly battery chemistry, and I don't know what that would be for this product because I don't know what the output impedance would be, but without being able to measure it because I couldn't ever take the thing apart while I was there, but I'm assuming that if you were to take this device and match the output impedance into a battery bank of the right chemistry, and that means it has to be a very stable chemistry. It's definitely not a polyion or polylithium ion because you're going to have an explosion on your hands. And I have experience with those, and they are very temperamental, and they will blow, as Sony learned when they just paid out $500 million for laptop batteries. If you were to do bank switching, and have these guys coming on and coming offline as they're able to, you would then diode isolate them or just bank switch them into a storage device like a battery or some chemistry that's friendly and take the energy from the storage device and not from this device. Let the device be isolated from the load in so much as it's just trickle charging or keeping or topping off a battery of some sort, and I would think that would help remedy the problem.
Okay. Let's talk about intellectual property. You said he did not file patents, but is there still an entity, or was there back then, that had ownership rights of the technology? So if somebody were to come forward today and successfully replicate this technology, would they have someone that they would have to answer to, so to speak?
Well, that's a problem because now after all this time, the right to sue has gone away. And I am certain that Stephen probably promised half a dozen key investors that they were the only one brought to the dance. But now, after that much time, without being an attorney myself, I don't know the law regarding that, but there could be surviving ownership after all this time, but it would be tied to at least non-disclosure or other secondary elements that would ensure that no one else knew about the technology, and that can't be the case today because it's been reported that Stephen was selling schematics on eBay or somewhere for a sum of money. So I think any agreements that were in place from before have been so badly breached that I can't see any survivability.
Okay. Well, let's talk now about chances of resurrection. What is the possibility that this technology could be brought forward and made to work?
Well, there's a secret, and that is that everybody who's working on it right now has to put their egos aside and think about the greater good and turning this entire design into an open source development environment. And that means that although there are a couple groups out there that are working together, there's probably still a lot of guys and independent little labs all over the place, you must understand that what made Stephen corrupt was the fact that he wanted this to himself and he was unwilling to share it with the world, even when very generous people came forward and paid for the right to share in it. That you must understand that for this to work, to get around any government interference or black helicopters and all the other things we all worry about, is to make this a completely open source project. That means everybody collaborates 100%, no secrets, no egos. No one guy wants to be the president of freeenergyinc.com or whatever you want to call it. It's got to be a bunch of equally shared members that put in the hard day's work. And in the end, when the device is finished, we all celebrate in mass rather than any one guy getting his ego massaged and getting his bank account filled up. The mission on this device is not a get-rich-quick scheme, as you've seen. If Stephen can't do it, and he's been married to this thing forever, seemingly, you have to realize that others around the world are doing the same thing and reaching the same brick wall, and that is the thermal runaway problem. You guys need to get together, check the egos at the door. I know a lot of you have already, but this has to become an open source project with 100% collaboration. And if I can help in any way, I'm very, very good at turning very difficult projects around. I'm not going to represent that I could give you any answers that you haven't already found, but need to work together, even on a larger scale, to get this done and to have it in so many hands that when it is successful, that introducing it to market in mass will make it very difficult for all the countering interests to prevent it.
Let me just put in a note on the side to our producer, Seth. I'm coming into a region now that is unstable on my cell phone, and if there's a chance I may drop out, if you just call me back. And Jack, you just keep right on talking if I drop out. The most susceptible place is about 5 minutes away, and it just lasts for a second or so you can just call me right back.
Okay. I will summarize what I just spoke of in the way of collaboration and open source development. There's a great example right now on the Internet where you can see the benefits of sharing and collaboration, and that is a new type of content measurement system called Joomla. It's J-O-O-M-L-A, and it is the most superior, sophisticated website technology ever introduced. And the reason why it's so successful now with over 12, 13 million sites online, and in fact that's where I'm going with my new site, is the fact that it was open source. You have people all over the world contributing their know-how and their hard labor, and it is taking over the entire Internet. And that's the way you have to think about free energy. No one guy can have an ego so large, like Stephen Marks, to prevent it from ever coming out. In other words, we can't die with our dreams or die with our secrets. It's better to share and better the world than think about ourselves individually at all.
I should mention, too, when you talk about open sourcing, that at overunity.com, which is a forum of all kinds of threads of technology, they do have an open source project that they call TPU, for Toroid Power Unit, and a number of people who are working on that. Are you familiar with that forum?
No. In fact, you have to understand I'm coming completely from left field, from a product development environment, and I have not kept track of this industry at all. So if I offend anyone by stating the obvious and that you're already there, forgive me, because I'm speaking from ignorance, that I'm only assuming that some of the breakthroughs in this are being halted by lots of individuals holding on to their own pride.
I should say that at that forum, the claim, one of the people who's on that forum is allegedly in contact with, as recently as 6 months ago, with Stephen Marks, who answers some questions, and he then conveys that to the group. So it's kind of a bone-picking type of scenario. I don't know if that's legitimate, but that's at least the claim that's been going on, and they've been going based on that information for quite some time.
Yeah, and you know, I've talked to the same party that you're referring to, and a real nice guy. He means well, but he himself, I don't think, is the direct conduit to Stephen. I have a feeling that there's so many intermediaries that I just simply don't trust any of the sources. I have withheld some key names and situations that only Stephen would know. So if I were to ever receive a phone call or an email, I'd be able to verify that it's him. But until then, I'm going to hold a couple a couple cards up my sleeve just so I can identify the party.
Okay. On now to the section in our questions where I'm going to get into some more particular questions about the minutia of how this thing works. Was there anything else on the general level that you wanted to address before we jumped into that?
Well, let me preface as we go forward that my exposure to the unit was superficial in that I had hands-on demonstration, but when it comes to any of the internal workings, I can only defer to the Tesla patent and what I could surmise from hands-on experience, but I sure can't represent that I know the inner workings of the technology.
Okay. As I'm going through this list, you've already addressed quite a few of these questions. Here's one. Did the device use low distortion sine waves to excite the control coils, or did it use digital pulses? And you've addressed that there were no control coils. Maybe you can speak to that question.
Well, I saw no external devices to the technology, and there were no circuit boards. So I cannot believe for the life of me that there was any submerged or embedded technology of any kind beyond the coils themselves and perhaps some means of excitation, but I certainly didn't see any.
Okay. Now we're to, these are questions from the TPU replication community. They post a few questions here. We've already addressed that one. And by the way, I'd like to go ahead and allow at this point, if people want to call in with a question, to allow that. Seth, if you want to go ahead and start beeping us through if we do get any calls, and we'll take those calls. If you are listening live, you can get those phone numbers to call in from at freeenergynow.net under today's listing for this show. We have a list of about four numbers you can call to join in on this conversation. Okay. Do you remember any preparation discussion on any strategy Steve wanted to use in order to decide where to do the cut on the TPU? This is when we were talking about how they went and they cut. I guess you mentioned that you were not privy to that process, so you probably won't be able to address that question.
Well, no, and I don't know why he would cut open the device. It doesn't make a lot of sense unless he was trying to figure out where the meltdowns were occurring, but it just seems odd.
How many feet of wire are we talking about on that 15-inch diameter unit?
How many what?
Feet of wire.
Oh, no way to tell. I mean, all I know is that the wire was readily available, and I've seen references to baling wire, and for all intents and purposes, it could have been. But the numbers of turns, you can almost tell by looking at depending on how good a quality your video is, but you can damn near measure the amount of turns because you can see them underneath the tape. Not on the large device, but on one of the smaller units.
And how many layers of wire do you think there were?
Two. A primary pair and a secondary pair.
Okay.
I shouldn't say pair. Let me correct that. There was four and four, so two sets of four.
When the unit was operating, did it make any sound? You said that there was a sensation that you could feel as it was going through the different phases around the toroid, but did it actually make a sound, clicking, ticking, snap?
No, nothing, no sound at all, except for if something was near it, you could kind of feel stuff around it singing, but only because it was creating a little bit of vibration into like a tabletop or something, but it wasn't the device itself.
Okay.
In other words, it was coupling vibration into other things, but it was not great in amplitude.
How many devices total were there that you were aware of?
At the time, four.
And Steve built all those?
I can't say. I don't know if any were obtained in the break-in or not, or if he had to replenish inventory.
Okay. What are the values when we're talking about the 15-inch diameter? What are the values of the two black capacitors and the two yellow capacitors?
Yeah, those are yellow, and they're a pair of polypropylenes. I could look to see if I can get a better image, but I doubt that there's going to be enough detail to actually see a component value. One thing that you have to consider, that the location of the caps compared to the choke that's on there, that is a circular device with a heavy gauge wire, those are either in parallel to provide smoothing for the output, or they're there as a function of resonance, where the capacitor is obviously fixed value, but the choke would have to be modified to arrive at the right inductance to create a tank circuit. But I doubt seriously that Stephen would have been creating tank circuits, because I didn't see any grid dip meters around or any other means of verifying or validating the number of windings or what the final inductive value would be. So I tend to believe that the polypropylenes are likely not a high capacitance rating, but a high voltage rating, which would be indicative of their package size.
Okay. We have a caller. Do you want to go ahead and ask the question? Caller? Okay,
hello?
I thought we had a caller. Let me go to this.
Hello?
Yeah. Can you hear a caller?
Yeah, that's me, Stefan Hartmann from overunity.com. Can you hear me?
Oh, hi, Stefan.
Yeah, hello.
Hey, go ahead.
Welcome to Jack, and thanks that he has been coming to the show. And I'm just recording that show now for later posting on overunity.com, and I invite you, Jack, to come over to our forum and maybe exchange with all the guys who are working in this moment on this using with you and your knowledge about it. Too bad that you didn't had any chance to look at some scope charts which you just said. But maybe you can clarify again with the 15-inch unit which we have seen on the videos on YouTube, which puts out about 800 volts voltage and about 1 ampere. So you got that wrong probably. which you told us before. So it's in the video Steve Mark said it's about 800 volts. Shop DC was about 1 amp of current coming out from the unit. That's why he put 8 100-watt bulbs in series, so he can match the output voltage, and then he gets about 800 watts of power on these 8 100-watt bulbs. So maybe you can go into the details, as you probably have seen this unit. There's a black box below these yellow polypropylene capacitors and these two toroidal chokes, which are sitting on top of it. Do you think inside there is a control circuit? There are also some other electrolytic caps, maybe, I don't know, maybe 3,000 microfarads. I don't know what output voltage, but they are standing right and left to this black box there in the center of this 50-inch unit. Do you have any idea what's in this black box?
Unfortunately, I got about 20% of your dialogue because of the phone connection, but what I did get toward the end was what the potential little black box was on the outside of the unit, and I could look further into that. I was wondering that myself. It looks to me more like just a means of interfacing to the device when outputting the output, but getting back to the choke and the capacitors, I have a pretty good video of it, and I need to get back into viewing it again after quite a while. And the choke is a very heavy-duty winding. It's a very large gauge wire, which would indicate that it's probably the smoothing capacitor choke pair, just like you would have on the output of any switching power supply. But I will do everything I can to identify the components further.
Yeah, that was Stephen Hartman, or Stephen Hartman. He's the owner and operator of the overunity.com forum over there. We really appreciate that venue that he's provided for this and many other subjects. We link to that from our website as well. If I caught part of what he said as well, he does invite anyone who wants to be involved in the replication of this technology to join that forum and to chime in with what's going on there. And of course, with the communication difficulty and the phone problem, it may be better to continue that particular dialogue via the forum, where it's easy to. Stephen's very good in his written English. He's not inadequate at all. So it should be easy to communicate there.
That sounds great. And once again, my sincere apologies if I might have offended anyone by implying that this is not a collaborative effort. It was only from my position of ignorance of not knowing that you were already collaborating that I made such a statement.
Well, I think it's good that you chimed in for the need for collaboration. The fact that it's already taken place is a nice bonus. I should also mention that we now have with us on the line as kind of a support person to help clarify any questions that may be coming up, Jason Owens. He's also involved in the TPU project over at overunity.com. And I'm actually on the road right now to an appointment, and I'm going to need to leave this call in probably about half an hour or so. He's going to take over if we're still going at that point. But Jason, go ahead and feel welcome to chime in and clarify anything if you'd like as we go forward on this. Back to the list of questions that were posted on the site. This is right after the two black capacitors, two yellow capacitors questions. Somebody says, there's a white connector. Do you know how many wires were on each side?
Can you reframe that?
There was a white connector on the 15-inch unit. Do you know how many wires were on each side of that white connector?
No, I'd have to review. It's been a decade. I'd have to see it again.
The two center toroid coils were mounted on their own original brackets. making these either off-the-shelf toroids or taking off some other equipment. Do you know anything about them?
No, other than the fact that chances are very good that they're off the shelf. Once again, Stephen did not trust anyone to help him in the way of technical support, so if he were left to his own talents, I do not see him having the ability to be trimming or changing values of inductors or creating tank circuits. I have a feeling that everything was pure trial and error.
Okay. A general comment that I'd like to bring in at this point gets on to a personal level, though. I understand that hypnosis can be really valuable in helping to recover clear memories of things that have happened in the past. Would you consider going under hypnosis to maybe recover your memory on some of these details to help the replication process?
You know, that's funny you should mention that. I'm actually a big believer in that, but more importantly, I actually have a photographic memory. I mean, I'm really good at recalling data, as in you could show me something from my childhood and I'd likely be able to identify it. I mean, unfortunately, the memory is solid. Otherwise, I'd say, yeah, that's a good idea, but I don't think it would get as far.
Yeah. We have another call in. Go ahead.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
Yep.
All right, wonderful. This is Ian Devices from overunity.com, Stefan's website, and I have a question for Jack. There are a number of videos, obviously, which have been shown, and I'd like to get a better feel for which models Jack has seen and held in his hand, and also I'm interested in the baling wire mentioned in one of the videos where Stephen Marks explained his smaller device.
Yeah, I was only present for the large device, and the smaller ones were around, and I could see them, you know, laying about, but the only one that I was actually able to see, touch, and feel was the large one. Unfortunately, I would have really liked to have dissected it to see exactly what was going on inside, but one thing I can tell you is that there weren't any hidden compartments. I mean, it was wide open internally, and there wasn't any hiding places that I could see. It looked like this device was no more than a lot of laborious winding. The wire can be seen underneath off-the-shelf electrical tape, and I'm sure at some point there's a junction box where all the windings are terminated or the coupling occurs, and that might be this little box that's off to the side because Stephen wasn't very artistic in his work, so I have a feeling that once the wiring left their target or their destinations, that he would have to terminate them into a larger box in order to keep it neat so you wouldn't be able to see the wires.
A question that goes along with this is that the TPU was mounted on some pretty thick wooden base material, and the skeptic would wonder if maybe there could be some 209-volt batteries hidden under the base of the TPU.
Well, first of all, we have to go over the fact that the 9-volt battery is the world's worst battery ever made when it comes to capacity. It is made up of 6 individual N-size cells that make it just an awful choice for any type of power outside of a transistor radio from the 70s. I mean, you hardly see the 9-volt cell being used anymore today. But if one were to go to that much trouble to bury those, first of all, the thickness of the 9-volt battery exceeded the thickness of the plate that the unit sat on. And if you look at the potential of him or Stephen submerging or embedding 9-volt batteries into a circular fashion into the larger unit, even the thickness of the wall of the larger unit wasn't big enough to be able to contain those batteries. So also, one other thing to look at is this device had to be readily available day in and day out as investors were coming and going. The likelihood of Stephen wanting to have to rip this thing apart between every demonstration to be able to change batteries is completely out of the question and just genuinely impractical.
Okay. What about the internal core material of the large GPU? Do you know anything, do you know what that was comprised of?
Yeah, it's all wood. The entire base is wood, and the form is a stack of, it looks like three or four of the speaker mounts that we used for the larger Extreme Technology speaker line. In fact, there was a magazine story on the Extreme products and the speakers, even in the magazine. I mean, that's all this thing is. It's just a form for him to wind on, and that's basically all this technology appears to look like to me, is it's some type of receiver that grabs power from, whether it be the Schumann cavity or what. That's where I go off into a ditch, because I just don't know.
Okay. Here's a question from Earl. It says, do you know about the stories concerning an American lawyer barred from U.S. practice living in the Philippines, somehow involved with a company called EUC, who supposedly has the rights to the TPU?
Well,
or at least the circuitry.
Okay, that's fine and dandy. There's probably going to be, and I have heard of that gentleman, by the way, and there's also many, many, many more that will make the same claim, because Stephen didn't think twice about doing multiple deals with multiple parties, likely using the same contracts. I can't say for certain, but the fact is that this exact technology that Stephen has been around for many, many years and decades, probably, before he got his hands on it. In fact, it was believed that there was a French scientist, I can't recall the name, but Stephen was so interested in following up on this scientist that he sent David Dolshaw to Europe to scour libraries in an attempt to find background on this one inventor slash scientist. And I do know from a very intelligent, reliable party that I have been honored to have met recently, stating that this device is actually in use in a couple areas around the country now, in so much as a development program, and they are getting results. So I know that anybody trying to make claim to this technology is going to be in deep trouble, because it's public domain. There's so many developers on this that I can't say who right now, but let's just say that one party has gotten to the point where they've gotten it to work, except that even with all their efforts, 20 minutes is the maximum time before meltdown.
One of the questions that I had about the meltdown is, why couldn't you use some of these thermoelectric coupling technologies to pull off that heat and generate electricity with the heat?
Well, the problem is with that technology, it's grossly inefficient. So, yeah, you may be able to develop a few watts of energy, but when you consider the scale of this power device, generating so much heat, trying to extract a couple watts of heat from it to run a little tiny motor, it would be like taking an Abrams tank to fly a kite. I mean, it's just not practical.
Okay. On some of the videos, the initials UEC are seen. Do you know what that stands for?
I know, but I've seen it on YouTube.
Because you mentioned earlier that the name of the company was, it had an E in it, so Extreme Technologies?
Yeah.
So is that part of the name, UEC?
Well, no, Extreme Technologies is a was an audio company that was an offshoot of Spheric Sound, which was the so-called 3D technology. But I should clarify that the company did produce a line of home theater products that genuinely did go on the market, and it was a viable company at one time. I have a garage full of the stuff. If anybody wants it, let me know.
Okay. Here's another question. I think you've already addressed this. Were tubes used at first, then replaced with solid-state control circuits?
One more time?
Were tubes used?
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
That,
and then,
no.
Did you want to finish?
Oh, I'm sorry. I said, yeah, that would be so visually indicative that there, it would be impossible to conceal or cloak a tube, even the smallest, like 12AX7 or something. That would be impossible.
Okay. Another question is asking for a shopping list of parts that went into making the units.
There were no parts list anywhere. The only thing he had was a shopping list that he put together for the gophers to go get parts. And that was primarily mercury.
Okay. That's the last of the questions from what was posted online. Can you think of anything minutiae-wise that we've not covered that you might be able to pull from your memory?
Well, unfortunately, on the technical side, I wish I could be of much more help, and it's frustrating to be a witness to this and not be able to help my compatriots that are out there in the labs all over the place pulling their hair out, because I can understand that this device is a very frustrating technology in that it's so unstable, unpredictable, subject to hazardous shock. It can't be fun, and I feel for the guys that are in the trenches fighting the battle. I wish I could have brought more on the technical front, but what I really wanted to do today, the real reason why I wanted to come forward, was to give hope to those that are in the trenches, the guys that are putting in the midnight hours. I've built a career on 16-hour days and not ever giving up on a dream, trying to get a product to market that most people gave up on. And one thing I can tell you, that you have to continue the battle and never, ever give up. It's too big to ever walk away from. So I understand the battle, but I think what I'm trying to get to, and I'm blathering, is that don't worship the man. The man behind the machine was a seriously flawed individual. I don't want to use the word con artist, but it's the only word that fits. The dream should continue because the technology was real. I saw it firsthand, and I wouldn't jeopardize my hard-earned credentials by saying so if it wasn't true. So I'm trying to tell you that it absolutely did work. It did have its instabilities. It did overheat, but that has to be fixable. And I want the deification of Steve and Mark to kind of subside so that the more important issue of the technology comes to the forefront, because the delivery boy wasn't reliable, but the end product was.
Okay, we've got another caller. Go ahead.
Is this Jason?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I have a question for Jack Durbin.
Yeah.
Jack, my name is WhatsApp, my username on overunity.com.
Hello.
And, hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Very good, thank
good.
You. I'd like to know, basically, on the outset when he came to see you, the situation, I guess, was that he had a working device, and he was asking you to see if you could not replicate, but make any similar type of device that could produce the same amount of energy?
Yes.
Okay, and that was probably, it could have been for either two reasons. One, to give his investors something other than what he had in hand.
Correct.
And the other would be to see if this technology could be easily replicated by others.
Yes, except that he never gave me, at that point in time, I had not seen the device. So I was starting fresh without any preconceptions and not even a characterization of the device by Mercury Marilla, who introduced me to Steven. So in other words, we were given a check to get started on the process without any preconceptions. In other words, I had no clue whether this was X, Y, or Z type of technology. Therefore, I did not go off with any preconceptions.
Okay. Another question?
Yes.
There is one of the devices on which he had placed two magnets. Are you familiar with that device?
No. It might be something I've seen just in the videos that are floating around, but I can't say I saw that firsthand, no.
Okay, so you never saw that one firsthand?
No. The only one I saw with a magnet was the big unit, and wasn't the big unit? I'm pretty sure it was the big unit, and I just thought it was entertaining that he was using it for just activating a read switch.
Okay, because the particular device I'm talking about had two magnets going on it, and there was a circuit. I was just wondering if you happened to see that circuit at one time or another.
You know, it might have been like on a bench or something, but I probably didn't pay much attention to it. I was fascinated, however, by the big one.
Okay, the question I think Jason had before about the cubes, he might have asked it in the wrong way. I think what he wanted to know was, did Stephen Marks use tubes in his initial R&D of this device before he migrated to any kind of solid-state situation?
Okay, I'm not aware that he ever went to a solid-state device. The only one I was privy to was the large unit. That was the, I don't know, the Rolls Royce of the line, I guess.
Okay, and in any discussions, tubes were never mentioned, frequencies, use of frequencies, there were two or three frequencies?
No, in fact, he was just so closed-lipped on everything that I found that if I asked any questions at all, he got agitated, and I could tell that he sensed that I was asking questions that might help me discover what he was up to, and he was just too damn secretive.
Okay. About the largest TPU, you mentioned that you have a very good quality video.
Yes, it's the same video that is on the Internet, except that it is not washed out in third or fourth or fifth generation, so when I look at it on my equipment, I have a full editing bay. Not only do I do product development, but I also have material that's for broadcast on QVC and other television outlets for products. And so I have to do video work all the time. So I'm going to pull this thing up out of the collection, and I will try to optimize the image enough to see more detail. But, yeah, the one I have is much better than the copies you see floating around.
Well, Jack, I mean, if you have the original, you can just put it in any type of video format. I mean, the guys at overunity.com are more than able to do whatever they have to do. You know, you don't have to go through all that trouble, basically.
Well, I would just assume that I might have more expertise in the video area than most, so I would probably want to clean it up for them a bit and just give them the detailed views. And what I did is I have looked at those segments, and they're very close up. They're the ones you see on the Internet, but they're much, much clearer.
Okay.
Just on behalf of OverUnity, I would mention that there's some really good talent over there in all areas, including video, rendering, animations, etc. There's a real qualified group of people over there, and when they get excited about something, they can really turn out some high-quality stuff.
Okay. I'll assume then that they're qualified.
Yeah,
I mean,
as have that
one video work.
If we could have that video as is, it would be worth a lot for a lot of people, you know, doing research right now, because one of the main quibbles was the quality of that video that we had to work with.
Yeah, it's awful.
And on behalf of the OverUnity Forum, I think they all would be very interested to see you actually join the forum and directly participate in that. Is that something you're willing to do?
Absolutely. I have a pretty busy schedule right now. I'm wrapping up a product for a group, but every once in a while I get a slot of time opened up. And if this looks like you guys are getting close and you need someone that's really good at troubleshooting and getting product to market, I'd be happy to help in any way I can.
Yeah. And also, I'd like to offer to you the resources of PezWiki.com, where you're already signed up with a username and password. It'd be a good place to put a frequently asked questions page, kind of a synopsis page, so that people don't have to read through 10,000 posts to get the meat.
No, that's a great idea, and I think your site is incredible. I commend whoever was behind the layout. It's very, very user-friendly.
Thank you. There's been a lot of hard work put into that.
You can see it.
Caller, did you have any more questions?
Maybe one more. Jack, Stephen Marks had indicated that he had a TV technician background.
That's possible.
That's possible?
Well, he had mentioned that he worked for RCA or somebody like that, but you have to understand that a TV technician level background would be like B-level technician real world. I mean, I did TV repair when I was a freshman in high school for a couple years just for, helping make ends meet. And it's not a very demanding field. We're talking, swapping tubes out and putting them in a tube tester or looking for a burned component. I mean, I could train my Chihuahua to do most of that.
Okay, and did he ever mention to you anything about a TV that blew up in Chicago?
No.
Nothing?
No, nothing. Well, let me make clear that we weren't like best of friends. I was brought in to do a task, and he kind of saw me as an adversary in a way, because he got to learn quickly that his bosses or the people that were backing his operation were dealing with me directly. So I think he thought of me as a threat to him in that I had to report to the same people he did. So he was very careful.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jack.
You're welcome, and great talking to you.
How much money would you say floated through the operation, and how many years was it going in its glory days?
Oh, I think the big window of time was probably 2 years, and I would say, and this is an estimate just based on what I had firsthand knowledge of, but probably $2 to $4 million.
Okay.
And that's what I knew of. There could have been cash transactions, because there was a couple guys offshore that were funneling cash into. One guy was in Australia. So there were legitimate investments being made and funneled through Spheric. And what you have to understand is that it was real muddied the way that the company was set up. There was a lot of incest between one company and the other, and how fundraising was accomplished. So, money would change hands, and it might have been intended for audio, but it leaked into energy, and the same players were the same guys on both entities. It was really commingled to the max.
We do have another caller. Go ahead and ask your question.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yep.
This is again Stefan Hartmann from overunity.com. I have another question for Jack.
Yes.
Jack, do you know if Steve Mark used iron wire in his coils, or was it just copper wire?
I would almost be certain that it was standard copper wire, because the wire was purchased at Radio Shack.
Yeah, you can also purchase iron wire at Radio Shack, don't you?
You mean iron as in magnetic wire?
That's right, like garden wire, like isolated garden wire for maybe fixing flower pots or something like this. Because we are at overunity.com, we think he's using iron wire or baling wire, which if you magnetize or if you pull iron wire, it has specific other characteristics to the voltage pulls. It's just getting magnetized this way, and Stephen Marks always spoke about kicks. Yeah, we can get kicks, and he tried to somehow gets this energy from the Earth magnetic field, he said, via Mr. Mannix from Australia. Do you know Mr. Mannix?
Yes, I've talked to him.
Okay. Was he related to this group, which was it Investors, or how was Mr. Mannix involved with that?
I don't believe he was involved in the early days, because I only learned of him much later.
So you don't know if it was iron wire or just copper wire?
No, the problem I have with iron wire, without the benefit of any other core material, I can't see the benefit. I don't understand how any type of magnetic induction would occur just by the fact of the wire composition without the benefit of a core.
Yeah, because iron wire is self-magnetic, and if you pulse it with high current pulses, it gets self-magnetic, and it's just like an iron core, you know, and then the electromagnetic field just also has no back EMF or different kind of back EMF, so it's very specific properties. So, and also, do you know if there were three coils as a receiver inside the TPU, inside the big TPU, because it was said to be three stacked coils in there in the big 15-inch unit?
No, that I cannot confirm. Everything I saw looked like it was in a quad layout. It was four opposing coils on both the primary and secondary, but that's only what I saw. I don't know if there were other versions.
So you also didn't look into the black box, which was inside in the center of the big coil?
Yeah, that was only the housing for the choke and the pair of polypropylene caps.
So there was no control circuit inside this black box?
I did not see any. Well, now, if there was something embedded in that assembly and was not visible, that's possible, but I did not see anything like that. I'd be the first to tell you that if I saw anything that looked like a circuit board. But I never saw any type of PCB tools or anything like that around that would indicate that he was working at the circuit board level on anything.
I see.
Now, I know that
because
for the company.
One other question to the overheating problem. How did he shut it down if the overheating occurred? Did it shut down automatically? Was there some kind of reed switch circuit which shut it down automatically? Or did he shut it down via pulling out the magnet for the reed switch? Or how did he shut it down?
Depends. Like during demonstrations, he would make sure that he would not exceed the time that he knew he'd be in trouble. So he would just disconnect the load. But when it would shut down by itself with load attached. It would just collapse.
Do you think it went out of synchronization then? And because it was said it was three frequencies which pulled together, or which in a kind of rotational way, this three frequency added up and produced beat frequencies like maybe 130 kilohertz and 70 kilohertz and 50 kilohertz, these three frequencies then produced beat frequencies, and also there it was said it was a 5,000 hertz shop DC output, about 800 volts and about 1 amps. So it was 5 kilohertz shop DC output with about 800 watts. So about 800 volts, you can see it on one video, it displays about 780 or something like this volts, and was said to have about 1 amps of output current at these 8 bulbs in series, so it had about, I don't think it's, do you think it's really working via the Schumann resonance, because that would only be 8 hertz then, but not 5 kilohertz.
Yeah, and that's where I just cannot help you. I just don't know. It's a very frustrating. I've heard references to the Floyd Sweet device and a lot of other ones that get close to this, but I did hear that Stephen Mark was putting out a schematic and that he was giving technical support to a couple guys who have the schematic. Now, I don't know if it was within your group or outside, but
according to what seemed to be a pretty credible source recently, said, yeah, we have a schematic, and they were going to send me a copy.
Well, I don't know. There are floating around a few Vark schematics. I haven't seen yet a fixed schematic. Mr. Mannix has interviewed Stephen Mark and came up with a few explanations, which he forwarded to us to our forum, but there are some other guys working on their own and trying to replicate that, but so far there is no fixed schematic from directly from Stephen Mark, as I know of.
Yeah,
so,
and that's the hard, that's the really difficult part. I have seen some of the emails that were supposedly from Stephen, and it some of the emails do look like the type of language he used in communications. It was, you know, little flowery speech with, I don't know what I would say, maybe overly formal language that was unnecessary. So he always tried to make himself look more Edisonian than not by flowering up his writing. So it did kind of look like his communications. But that was 2004.
I see. So you were more involved in the overall, marketing stuff not directly replication stuff, but only with handling the different interests in this circuit. So you don't have any inside technical knowledge about the used frequency and the used wires and the used LC tanks and the stuff. Is that right?
Well, I was on the technical side, and I developed product for the sister company, but when it came to being able to help Stephen in a hands-on way, he allowed no one to help him when it came to the details of the device because he was worried about, you know, someone running away with the technology. He was very paranoid. So I wish I could tell you that I helped him build it, but I did not, and all I can tell you is what I saw and witness statements from, like, the guy who was his boyfriend at the time, who was actually more interested in getting the technology than staying with Stephen, which I thought was interesting because it seemed like Stephen was surrounded by people who wanted the device more than his friendship. So his paranoia was justified. But this individual said, look, I went on the runs for all the materials, and it was only Radio Shack. And when it comes to the choke in the polypropylene caps, I don't recall Radio Shack ever selling those devices. Now, perhaps the caps, at one time Radio Shack used to, you know, sell assortment bags of capacitors, but I seriously doubt they would have polypropylene. So he had to have had another source for the more sophisticated components, but for the most part, this thing was made from, you know, technology available at Radio Shack.
Okay, many thanks for these infos. Maybe you can just come to overunity.com and sign up freely and tell us some more infos all around this stuff, which people you have met over there, which other people were involved, and maybe if you can disclose that, or maybe not, I don't know. There are some videos out there which show some other people looking at it. Maybe you can still remember the names of these guys so we can contact these.
Okay, I will do it. I will do everything I can to provide more information. Like I said, today's goal was really to just open the door, so to speak, to future development. And just to say that Stephen Mark, although he is the guy in the U.S., so to speak, that has it, there's many other places in the world where this exact same technology is underway, and that there's hope because people have developed this all the way to the finish line. It's just that the stability issue remains, even with the guys who had the big budgets and finished it. They still have the 20-minute meltdown.
Yeah, I see that the meltdown could be explained by using iron wire because iron wire is pretty fastly heated up compared to copper wire. So I guess it's probably then iron wire inside the TPU, maybe. But I don't know, but it could be explained via this effect.
Yeah, and I'll be happy to help any way I can, but I'll try to reach the party that has the more further developed unit, but we'll see if they part with any technology.
Okay, many thanks. I will close this down now, my questions, maybe some other calls are on the line, and thank you, Sterling, for bringing this forward and for this great show then. Thanks, bye-bye.
Take care. Are we still on the air? Are we still here?
Hello?
F-team, 1, 2, 3.
Are you on the line, Jason?
I guess I am. I'm listening.
Okay.
Okay. My phone dropped out. I just wanted to pass the baton on to you. If you want to keep this going, you can. We covered a lot of territory. I think this may be a good place to stop. What are your thoughts, Jack?
I think I've carried on long enough. I think, just to summarize, that I'm glad to see there's so many people working on this. Coming from left field after 10 years, I had no idea that there was such a movement going on. And if I can help in any way I can, I'm not looking for work, but if there's anything at all I can lend to the future of this device, I would sure like to see it finished after being a part of it for a short period of my life. So I'm at anyone's disposal. If they have any questions, feel free to reach me through my site or through the from your site.
All right. Thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it. You've been listening to Jack Durbin. This is Free Energy Now radio show. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. Join us every week. We are usually on Monday, noon to 1 Pacific. Thanks again.
Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.